John Updike sat in a rented one-room office each morning for decades, typing stories and essays and poems and novels on a manual typewriter. In a piece for The Guardian, he once wrote, "I felt that I was packaging something as delicately pervasive as smoke, one box after another in that room, where my only duty was to describe reality as it had come to me, to give the mundane its beautiful due." Here's how he put it several years later to the Academy of Achievement.
Well, if in a democracy and in the 20th and now the 21st century, if you can't base your fiction upon ordinary people and the conflicts which the struggles, the issues that engage ordinary people, then you're reduced to writing about spectacular, unreal people, adventures. And the trick about fiction, as I see it, is to make an unadventurous circumstance seem adventurous, to make it excite the reader, either with its truth or with the fact that there's always a little more than goes on. I mean, there's multiple levels of reality. As we walk through even a boring day, we see an awful lot and feel an awful lot, and to try to say some of that seems more worthy than cooking up thrillers.
Not that Updike disliked thrillers, to the contrary, but his very substantial contribution to American literature during the second half of the 20th century and a decade into this one was to illuminate the everyday life and turmoil of white middle-class America. Two-time Pulitzer Prize winner John Updike died 10 years ago this week as I record these words. We revisit his legacy and his wisdom about the writing life on this episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth, darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
It takes a certain kind of patient temperament. You have to be willing to sit in a room day after day and sort of talk to an imaginary reader. Imagine that you're entertaining this reader and that some kind of electricity is being generated. So it's not for everybody, but it suited me fine. Maybe takes some basic shyness. You are trying to be a craftsman as well as a prophet and a rabble-rouser, and it's the craftsman that shows up day after day in the office, even on days when the priest and rabble-rouser fails to turn out.
It's hard to think of anyone better suited temperamentally to be a writer than John Updike, and the sheer volume of his output is a testament to that. Over 60 books, including 23 novels, memoirs, and collections of hundreds, maybe thousands, of stories, essays, and literary criticism. But growing up, he didn't want to be an author at all. He loved the humor writing in The New Yorker, the magazine he would later become conjoined with, I guess you could say. But as a kid, it was the New Yorker cartoons that held greater sway for him. He even had ambitions to become an animator for Disney. That excerpt you just heard was Updike speaking to students and other honored guests, including Norman Mailer, at the Academy of Achievement Summit in Chicago in 2004. After making his remarks, he sat down to record a conversation with Gail Eichenthal for the Academy's archive. They started by talking about his childhood in Shillington, Pennsylvania, the town outside of Reading where he was raised by both his parents and his grandparents, the town that would take fictional form in many of his stories and his most famous books, Rabbit Run and the sequels that followed.
My mother's parents had the house, and my father had the earning ability, such as it was, so they combined forces about the time I was born in 32. It was the Depression, and my grandfather had been a man of some means. He had retired from farming, bought some securities, and then the securities let him down. So I was born into a fairly dire situation, and I think one of the reasons that I never had any siblings was that it was economically pinched, and my father didn't feel entitled to invite any more people into the world. But for the one that did get through, me, it was kind of bliss. Actually, I had all this adult attention, and whatever adult energy was there was focused on me, and my grandparents were quite, they were old country folk, would speak Pennsylvania Dutch between themselves, and although my grandfather spoke a rather elegant English. Yeah, they moderated the effect of my parents, so it was nice. My mother had a degree. She was unusual in that generation in that she had a master's degree, had got one at Cornell, and was hoping to become a writer or something artistic, but instead she took a job selling drapes in the local department store, and she did that for a couple of years. I remember the department store with your mother behind the drapes counter is kind of a romantic place. I mean, this, all these goods and the smells of the department store for a child, and escalators, which were a novelty then. But she then, when my father got a job teaching, she became a housewife and stayed a housewife. It was nice. I can't complain. It was a fairly crowded neighborhood, so there were lots of other children. The town itself was small and compact, the kind of town you can ride from one end to the other on a bike without too much danger or pumping. This was my horizon. Shillington first, Reading on halfway to the horizon, and on the extreme horizon, Philadelphia, where we went maybe 2-3 times a year.
So life was pretty good in Shillington. But then, when he was 13, the family moved 11 miles away to his mother's birthplace, a stone farmhouse on an 80-acre farm in Plowville. And that presented John Updike with a lot of time to read.
Yeah, of course I had read somewhat before. I mean, I was an only child, after all, and only children tend to read. And my mother was a keen reader. My grandfather was a Bible and newspaper reader. So I saw a lot of reading around me, and it's a world a child can control. There were things called big little books then, which were essentially bound comic strips, one panel and opposite a page of text, and it was an easy way to read. So I read a lot of those, and then I graduated to mystery novels, some science fiction. I loved Agatha Christie, of course, and also an American team called Ellery Queen. I read a lot of Ellery Queen. Earl Stanley Gardner. I must have read 40 books by Earl Stanley Gardner before I was 15 or so. So I got the reading habit, and that was, and I slightly branched out, you know, I challenged myself. I remember at the age of 15 going into the library and pulling down The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot and reading it because I'd heard that this was a modern masterpiece. So it was random reading, but maybe that's the best kind in a way. It's not forced on you. And you get these glimpses now and then of the wonderful world of books. It was in Reading, there was a lovely Carnegie-endowed library with walls of books. And I remember I read through a whole shelf of P.G. Woodhouse. Again, my taste was to humor, I think, and it's odd that I didn't become a humorist, really, although there's some humor perhaps in my work. But I began, my first ambition as a writer was to become a humorous writer, to be like Thurber and Benchley and the lighter E.B. White, you know, to make people laugh. I thought that was a harmless thing to do, thing that society never could have too much of, laughter. Anyway, I did a lot of reading. I remember I used to lie on this old sofa with a box of raisins, and I would read as many as 2 books in one afternoon and eat maybe, I hope not the whole box, but a fair amount of the box of raisins. That was my diet for a while.
It's a pretty idyllic memory. But John Updike remembers finding the move from his small town to an even smaller one somewhat challenging, even though he was able to keep attending his old school where his father was a math teacher.
I think any move annoys a child a great deal. All a child asks is that the world hold still while he or she grows up. and many of us don't get that wish. I was happy in Shillington, and I was a school teacher's son. I had a slight presence. I wasn't especially popular or athletic or anything, but I was smart, schmart, as they used to say. And so I was fine in Shillington, and I kind of knew the ropes, but my mother wanted to get back to the soil and back to her own roots, which were at this farm. It wasn't the most traumatic thing, like moving to Los Angeles when you're living in the Bronx. That would be traumatic. But no, I continued to go to the same school with my father. I became a commuter. He and I became joint commuters. And in a way, I saw a lot more of my father than most boys, American boys, do. So that was good. He and I went back and forth together, had adventures. I've written about this in a number of places, but a novel called The Centaur is my main monument to those days with my father. Struggling for the dollar, and cars that keep breaking down, snowstorms that keep coming under your wheels. But it was beautiful because I saw what it was like to be an American man. I saw that it's a struggle. Not easy to be an American man.
Those insights became the fodder for much of Updike's literary outpouring, and they helped establish his reputation as an incisive observer of the human complexity behind the facade of conventional life. His writings sometimes even stirred controversy, especially during the 1960s and 70s, with their forthright depictions of adultery and America's changing sexual mores. Not to get ahead of myself, though, we still don't know just how he cottoned to becoming a writer in the first place.
My mother had dreams of being a writer, and I used to see her type in the front room. The front room was also where I would go when I was six, so I'd sit there and watch her. And clearly she was making a heroic effort, and the things would go off in brown envelopes to New York or Philadelphia even, which had the Post in those years. And they would come back. And so the notion of it being something that was worth trying and could indeed be done with a little postage and effort stuck in my head. But my real art interest, my real love was for visual art. And that was what I was better at, it was considered at first. My mother saw that I got drawing lessons, some painting lessons. I took what art the high school offered. I went to Harvard, still thinking of myself as some kind of potential cartoonist. And I got on the Harvard Lampoon as a cartoonist, actually, not as a writer. But the writing maybe was more my cup of tea. There were some very gifted cartoonists over the Lampoon. You wouldn't expect to find too many at Harvard, but actually they were quite good, about three of them. And I saw that maybe there was a ceiling to my cartooning ability, but I didn't sense the same ceiling for the writing because I'd hardly given it a try. By the time I got out of Harvard, I think I was determined or pretty much resolved to becoming a writer if I could.
Gail Eichenthal asked Updike whether back then he had in mind becoming a novelist, a nonfiction writer, or even a poet.
I did write a lot of light verse and even some verse that wasn't too light. I don't think even I knew there was no living in being a poet. So fiction was the game. The writers I admired, a lot of them had written numerous essays like Robert Benchley, and I did do my share of those things when I was younger, sold a few of them. But I found when I attempted fiction, that, you know, it's like a sort of a horse you don't know is there, but if you jump on the back, there is something under you that begins to move and gallop. And so it's clearly a wonderful imaginary world that you enter when you begin to write fiction. So I guess my hope was to become a fiction writer. I was prepared to fail. I was prepared to not be able to get things accepted, because I saw that happen to my mother. I knew that not everybody who tried to write actually got published. That in fact, that's kind of a long odds proposition. But I figured if I'd give myself 5 years, and if I couldn't get into print in 5 years, I should know that I didn't have what it took. But as it turned out, I got into print pretty readily. I actually sold a few poems in my teens to marginal magazines. I remember one poem of the boy who makes the blackboard squeak, meaning the sort of naughty boy who makes the chalk squeak deliberately. But I was paid maybe $5 or $10 for it. But my hope was to get into the New Yorker magazine, which began to come into the house when I was about 11 or 12. The New Yorker was not a Berks County thing. There may have been a few subscribers, but the newsstands did not carry it because I used to look for it. But my aunt, who lived in Greenwich, Connecticut, and was kind of a hip lady, she was my father's sister. She thought that we, as a benighted provincial household, could use the New Yorker, and I, in fact, did use it. I loved it, read it, the cartoons, but then other things, too. The whole tone of the magazine was so superior to any other slick magazine. So I was aimed at the New Yorker, and my writing career really begins with the day in June of 54 when word came up, we were staying with my wife's parents in Vermont, word came up that there was a letter from the New Yorker and they'd taken a poem. And then a little later that summer, they took a story. So I felt, rightly or wrongly, kind of launched as a writer, a real writer.
That was the month after he finished college. The poem was called Duet with Muffled Break Drums, four humorous little stanzas inspired by a Rolls-Royce ad. The first story he had accepted by the New Yorker was Friends from Philadelphia, about male one-upmanship, class, and cars.
That winter, that semester, I think I placed four or five more stories with them, as well as quite a number of light verse poems. Light verse was in its twilight, but I didn't know that, so I kept scribbling this stuff, and they kept running it for a while. So I was kind of establishing myself as a dependable contributor. And they were a paternalistic organization that tried to gather unto itself talented, whatever, writers.
They scooped him up and hired him as staff. He was 22 or 23 years old, and until that moment, was still working on becoming a cartoonist.
Well, I was in Oxford the year after college with my then wife, who had been a Radcliffe girl. And she was at that point a pregnant Radcliffe girl. And so I had a little girl in April. And about that same time, Catherine White, who was the fiction editor and a woman of great power, one of the founding members, really, of the New Yorker in 25, and her more famous husband, E.B. White, came to visit us in our basement flat and indeed offered me a job. Or maybe she just told me I should see Sean the editor, when I got back to the States. And I did, and he offered me a job. And I worked in New York for about 2 years. And it was funny to want to do that because really, about the only slot they had to offer was to write for Talk of the Town, the front section. And we moved in, little family of three, into Riverside Drive. I began to write these stories and discovered I could do it and had kind of a good time doing it. You went around to New York and interviewed people or attended Coliseum show of kitchen appliances or whatever. And I was very good at making something out of almost nothing. But I thought after 2 years that maybe I'd gone as far as I could with the talk of the town as an art form. And I felt New York was kind of an unnatural place to live. I had two children at this point. My wife didn't have too many friends and wasn't very happy. Although in the 50s, one didn't think too hard about whether or not your wife was happy, sad to say. But even I could see that. So I said, why don't we quit the job for a while? I thought they'd take me back if it didn't work out, and I'll try to freelance up in New England. So there's where we went, moved to a small town in New England, and I never had to go back because I was able to support myself.
Of course, he still published in The New Yorker. In fact, constantly over the next 50 years as both a short story writer and a literary critic. So it wasn't a clean break, but it was still a daring thing to do for a very young writer with a family to support.
But I felt that I would be better off in what I thought of as real America. That is, in New York, everything is stratified. The people I knew were other writers. And although it's not a major industry, it was enough of a local industry that everybody was watching everybody else, and I felt like I was being crowded in a way. Small town, you have good odds of being the only writer and people not really taking an interest in what you do. So you are on your own as a person. And that's how it worked out. I thought it was successful.
That's an understatement. By 1960, when he was 28, Updike had published two novels. The second was Rabbit Run, which would launch him into the literary stratosphere. The book's main character, Harry Engstrom, who goes by the nickname Rabbit, has been held up as one of the iconic characters in American literature. Rabbit is a former high school basketball star whose glory days are behind him. He's 26 when the book begins, in a dead-end marriage, working as a kitchen gadget salesman. He feels trapped in his middle-class life, and when he finds out his wife is pregnant with their second child, he bolts, hoping to find some kind of meaning, but whatever he's looking for, it isn't out there. Here's an excerpt from the audiobook, narrated by actor Arthur Morey.
Growing sleepy, Rabbit stops before midnight at a roadside cafe for coffee. Somehow, though he can't put his finger on the difference, he is unlike the other customers. They sense it too, and look at him with hard eyes, eyes like little metal studs pinned into the white faces of young men sitting in zippered jackets in booths, three to a girl. The girls with orange hair hanging like wiggly seaweed, or loosely bound with gold barrettes like pirate treasure. At the counter, middle-aged couples in overcoats bunch their faces forward into the straws of gray ice cream sodas. In the hush his entrance creates, the excessive courtesy the weary woman behind the counter shows him amplifies his strangeness. He orders coffee quietly and studies the rim of the cup to steady the sliding in his stomach. He had thought, he had read, that from shore to shore all America was the same. He wonders, is it just these people I'm outside? Or is it all America?
Each decade after Rabbit Run was published, Updike returned to his character with a sequel, Rabbit Redux in 1971, Rabbit is Rich in 1981, Rabbit at Rest in 1990, and a novella, Rabbit Remembered, in 2000. The third and fourth books in the series each won a Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah, I didn't write that with any idea of a sequel. But the book does kind of end on a hovering note, and people asked me, well, what happened? And enough asked me, not too many, but a few, put a bee in my bonnet, that when I had run out of subjects, I thought, well, why not tell what happened and bring Rabbit back? This was during the late 60s when there was a lot of turmoil in America. And so I brought him back as this time as kind of an everyman who was witnessing the pageant of protest and disturbance, distress, drug use, everything. Almost everything was in that book, including the moonshot. In fact, the moonshot's kind of a central event in it. So that the rabbit who came back the second time was a much more purposefully representative American than my initial rabbit. He was just a high school athlete who had nowhere much to go after he graduated. Whereas the second rabbit is kind of a growing man, trying to learn in a way. And I've seen rabbit, and indeed Americans as general, as learners, as willing to learn. They may be slow to learn, but there is an openness to our mindset that I think enables us to overcome our mistakes or our prejudices and move forward.
When the novelist Joyce Carol Oates reviewed Rabbit at Rest for the New York Times, this is how she described Updike's accomplishment. John Updike, with his precision prose and his intimately attentive yet cold eye, is a master, like Flaubert, of mesmerizing us with his narrative voice, even as he might repel us with the vanities of human desire his scalpel exposes. One of the ways Updike was able to traverse decades of American life with such immediacy in his rabbit books was that he wrote them in the present tense.
I found that the present tense, which I began to write Rabbit Run in, was a great liberator. Somehow, I loved writing in the present tense, and it's become a bit of a cliche now among younger writers, but at the time it was a bit of a novelty, and certainly a novelty to me, and there's a kind of a level of speed you can get going without the past tense that was suitable to Rabbit and also suitable to me as a writer, because the books wrote themselves fairly easily. I say that now, I'm not sure it was always easy, but basically the present tense plus the combination that this was a landscape that was in my bones.
There were moments, Updike said in other interviews, when he wondered whether maybe he wrote Rabbit a little too fast, and he faced a dilemma when new editions were published of whether to go back in to make changes.
I've rewritten the early books to some extent. Rabbit Run had some legal troubles. It was considered racy at the time, and so some sexually explicit bits were taken out, and they were later restored. So I was happy. I put them back because the climate suddenly became, you know, what's the fuss? And then again, I've looked at them. I reread the whole bunch when they were put into an Everyman 4-volume. So there has been some rewriting. There's a danger of an older man rewriting a younger man, though. You might just throw out the baby with the bathwater somehow. When you're young, I think you're so surprised to find yourself writing at all that you jump on almost any word that will work. And when you're older, you sort of know there are lots of words that you could use. And so your writing becomes a little less inspired and a little more plodding and careful. But I did marvel at some of the phrases that the younger Updike tossed off. I mean, I thought, I couldn't do this now, I said to myself. So I'm glad I did it when I could do it.
You were a little more devil may care?
Yeah, devil may care, and maybe more fully persuaded that I had something unique to bring, that to these ordinary people and ordinary days, to some extent, I was bringing a kind of verbal care, a verbal elegance even, that they wouldn't otherwise get. So in a way, I felt I had a franchise to maintain, and maybe the writing is too self-cherishing in spots, but I know the saying that you should write invisibly, that writing should be invisible. I think people know they're reading a book and that this object in front of them is a page of words, so I've always felt no, what I really like in a book is the sense that the writing is itself entertaining or interesting, or makes you want to read a sentence twice, that kind of thing I like in other authors and tend to do it myself.
His writing was also always rich in description.
I think I try harder to visualize the physical setting, the room, the dress, the face. Not sure I always succeed. And there's a way in which you can suffocate an image under words by putting too many. You know, you can handle, say, a pale young lady with arched eyebrows, but once you start going into the eyebrows hair by hair and do the earrings on top of it, you get sort of no image. You get no image. So you have to watch this tendency to over-specify. But I think it is good to, Conrad spoke about helping the reader, making the reader see. He italicized the word, and I think there is that in my writing, a belief that seeing is not quite all, but seeing is a lot of it. And so I hope to see it in my own mind and then to transfer it to the reader's mind as best I can. But, you know, readers are different. They all have different experiences. Bed, the word bed means one thing to you, another thing to me. So in a way, you were never read exactly the way that you would have read yourself. But nevertheless, we're all in the same rough human ballpark here, and I think communication can occur.
John Updike was so at ease talking about writing, his own and others. It was partly the result, for sure, of the many years, decades, he spent as a prolific literary critic at the same time that he was churning out novels and short stories. That's something we haven't really touched on yet, the other facet of his absolute dominance in the pages of The New Yorker.
I didn't set out to become a reviewer much, but I did. I was a New Yorker writer and looking for any way in which I could appear in the magazine and sell, and I began to drift into reviewing in about 1960. Not very many at first. They had other reviewers, but as they died off, I became for a while then almost the main reviewer. I did more reviews than anybody else. And you could say I was doing too many. I did try to avoid American contemporaries, many of whom I knew, because who knows where envy or friendship enter in and distort the honesty of the book report. So I tried to review foreign or dead or Latin American, European or Latin American writers. There was a lot of ferment then, magic realism. The novel in Europe was much more overtly experimental than I'm aware of its being now. So I thought there were things I could learn just as a reader from reading these books. So I tried to read books that would further my own education as well as earn me the money of the book review and keep me up. It's very easy to, when you've written for those 3 or 4 hours, your appetite for words is rather diminished, so it's all too easy to go to not read much. So the reviews did keep me reading and acquainted with, you know, trends in what do we do with this old dinosaur of the novel? You know, what new can we? Because the novel is a very capacious plastic. It's sort of what you make it. And it's taken many forms. Ulysses is, you can't repeat that, but that is an example of a novel that really tried to do everything. So we postmoderns are faced with this notion that maybe we're not taking it far enough. We're accepting the old conventions, quote marks, and he said, she said, and when we've had these experimental writers who've done so much. So anyway, it's good in a way to make yourself think about these basic issues. Why are you doing this at all? What are you bringing to it that's different? Are you just feeding the machine, or are you in some way altering the machine? All these things are probably, up to a point, useful. But in the end, you're left with your own intuitions and your own sense of whatever, beauty or meaning or urgency.
With all the wise, fascinating things John Updike had to say about writing, you might assume he'd spent time, as so many writers do, as a professor, and he certainly looked the part. But you'd be wrong. He assiduously avoided teaching aspiring young writers his whole career, with one brief exception.
You hesitate to give advice to young writers because there's a limit to what you can say. It's not exactly like being a musician or even an artist where there's a set number of skills that have to be mastered. I marvel at musicians, by the way, that people can play the piano and the violin with that speed and that accuracy. Obviously, they need a lot of training. I'm not sure sometimes writers need no training, and some of the amateur ones who just jump in do better than the ones who have the PhD in creative writing. Colleges are very willing now to teach you. Harvard asked me to do the creative writing course one summer, and I did it, and there were some good students, and there were some students who didn't show up, and there were some indifferent students. It was 15 in all. But I found that the effect upon me was not good, because these things didn't seem that much worse than stuff I was writing at the same time. I mean, and this effort of this is approaching a piece of fiction as though there's something slightly wrong with it that can be fixed. Is maybe not the gestalt approach that a real writer ought to have. So this sort of wanting to lift it up to one more level of readability or interest, all that. Some men and women can do it. Joyce Carol Oates seems to thrive on teaching. But for me, it just made the precariousness of what I was doing all the more evident to me.
No, for John Updike, life as a writer had to happen within the confines of a small office in a small town. And it had to happen on a schedule, day in and day out, right up almost until the day he died. He described his routine to Gail Eichenthal in their 2004 conversation, and we'll end with that.
Since I've gone to some trouble not to teach and not to have any other employment, I have no reason not to go to my desk after breakfast and work there until lunch. So I work 3-4 hours in the morning. And it's not all covering blank paper with beautiful phrases. It's you begin by answering a letter or two. There's a lot of junk in your life as a writer, and most people have junk in their lives, so there's But I try to give about 3 hours to the project at hand and to move it along. There's a danger if you don't move it along steadily that you'll kind of forget what it's about. So you must keep in touch with it, I figure. It saves you from giving up. This present novel that will be out, The Villages, I several times thought it might be a bad idea and kind of abandoned it. So it was really the habit of writing that kept me at it. In the end, it was like a bad marriage. I mean, whatever, this is the wife I'm married to here, and I'm going to finish this book. Finishing it becomes the only way to get rid of it. So yes, it's good to have a certain doggedness to your technique. In college, I was struck by the fact that Bernard Shaw, who became a playwright only after writing 5 novels, would sit in the British Museum, the reading room, and his quota was something like maybe 5 pages a day. But when he got to the last word on the last page, whether it was the middle of a sentence, he would stop. And so this notion that when you have a quota, whether it's 2 pages or 3 is how I think of it, 3 pages, that it's a fairly modest quota, but nevertheless, if you do it, really do it, the stuff will accumulate. So once embarked, yes, I do try to stick to a schedule. I've been maintaining this schedule often, well, really, since I moved up to Ipswich in 57. It's a long time to be doing one thing. Yeah, I don't know how to retire. I don't know how to get off the horse, though. I still like to do it. I still love books coming out. I love the smell of glue and the shiny look of the jacket and the type, and to see your own scribbles turned into more or less impeccable type is still a great thrill for me, so I will probably persevere a little longer, but I do think maybe the time has come for me to be a little less compulsive, maybe abandon the book a year technique, which has been basically the way I've operated.
He never did. Between 2004, when this conversation was recorded, and 2009, when he died of cancer at 76, John Updike published exactly a book a year. 2 books of essays and 3 novels. The last one, The Widows of Eastwick, came out just 2 months before his death. You can hear more from the Academy of Achievement's interview with John Updike at achievement.org. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes. What It Takes is generously funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening.